Hey folks, Scott Horton here for Veterans for Peace at veteransforpeace.org. I'm not a vet, but if you are, I'd like to ask you to consider joining Veterans for Peace. As you know, in matters of foreign wars, a veteran's voice is given much more weight. Well, Veterans for Peace is making veterans' voices heard in ways and places where they can really make a difference. There are more than 175 chapters of Veterans for Peace in all 50 states, working hard to eliminate nuclear weapons, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and abolish war as an instrument of American national policy. It's the peace vets versus the chicken hawks. Join up the good fight at veteransforpeace.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here. After the show, you should check out one of my sponsors, WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by Mike Swanson, a former hedge fund manager who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Mike's site, WallStreetWindow.com, is unique in that he shows people what he's really investing in, updating you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike's betting his positions are going to go up due to the Federal Reserve printing all that money to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane, at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest on the show today is Clive Stafford Smith. He is the founder and director of Reprieve, and he's the author of the book Torture Team that I was telling y'all about earlier in the hour. His latest piece at The Guardian is called Yunus Rumatullah, maybe. The U.S. and U.K. caught committing a crime together. Welcome back to the show. Clive, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Scott. Thank you for welcoming me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here, and very happy to have you writing about this stuff. Otherwise, I guess we just wouldn't know. First of all, please tell us who, well, how do I say this guy's name, and then who is he?
Yeah, look, I'll help you with the name first. Yunus Rahmatullah and also a guy called Amanatullah Ali were two people picked up by the Brits in Iraq back in 2004. And actually, one of the great untold stories here is that the British thought that Amanatullah Ali was a big-time terrorist with Laskar-e-Taiba, L-E-T, which, as I'm sure you know, is a Sunni terrorist group out of the eastern part of Pakistan, where they're trying to get freedom for Kashmir, effectively. Well, actually, Amanatullah Ali was a Shia rice farmer, and if he went anywhere near L.E.T., he would get killed by them because they're not big fans of Shias. And he has absolute proof that he was innocently in Iraq, because the Shias back then could only just get into Iraq because Saddam had gone, and for the first time you could get to the Shia holy site. So the Brits pick him up, turn him over to the United States, who then take him to Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan along with Yunus, and they've held him there for the last 8 years.
And then, now, how long have they known that he was just in the wrong place, wrong time?
They don't accept that today, and it's, as I mentioned, one of the great untold stories. The British still bang on as if he's this guy called Ahmed Dilshan. And indeed, if you look at the released list of prisoners in Bagram, they have him listed as Ahmed Dilshan, and that's not who he is. I mean, we've proven who he is. I've met his brother several times in Pakistan. And Yunus Rahmatullah, likewise, is no terrorist. But they've held him there for 8 years. And the problem with Bagram is it is Guantanamo's evil twin sister. But very few people know much about it, and lawyers have never been allowed in there. I've not been able to get in there. All that I've been able to derive has been from investigating the case outside.
Now, is it your understanding still, or, well, I don't want to be too presumptuous, but I guess this, I think, was kind of common knowledge back a couple of years ago, was that there was a Bagram prison, and then there was the wink-wink, nudge-nudge, real Bagram prison, the secret one on the other side of the hill that everybody knew about, where you can hear screams late at night.
Well, I mean, sometimes you could hear them, sometimes you couldn't. There was an underground section to Bagram, and some of the people I've represented were held there. And, you know, these are people now I've met with because they're in Guantanamo, mm-hmm. or now some are free. There was an underground section which was kept totally secret, and the Red Cross couldn't get in there and so forth. Now, there are still two parts to Bagram. There's one that's been turned over to the Afghans. That there are 50 foreign nationals, including about 30 Pakistanis, who are held in the other part, which the U.S. continues to hold on to. Because they haven't, for example, with Rahmatullah and Ali, they haven't turned those two guys over to the Afghans, because how could they? Neither of them had ever been to Afghanistan until the U.S. took them there. So these are not people who are legitimately anyone's prisoner, really, but certainly not the Afghans' prisoners. So they're still held by the U.S. in this separate part of Bagram.
Mm-hmm. But now, I thought that there was some kind of process. I won't say I understood the whole thing or remember the whole thing, but Daphne Abiatar has been to Bagram, and she talked with some of these prisoners. Maybe that was at the one prison, not the other kind of thing or something. But isn't there some kind of process for getting a hearing to get out of Bagram,
or
no?
There's what they call a detainee review board, which is a place where you're not allowed lawyers, even though we've offered to go there and help them. And indeed, both of these guys, both Rahmatullah and Ali, have both been cleared for release. And Yunus Rahmatullah was cleared 2 years ago, and he's still there. This is similar to the problem in Guantanamo Bay, that people have been cleared for a long, long time, and they're still there. And when you ask why, there's no good answer for that. I suppose one thing you have to accept is that perhaps people have finally worked out that they're not the terrible terrorists they were meant to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I know they put, I don't know if it was an official rule, but at least it was announced that, well, if you're Yemeni, we're never sending you home from Guantanamo because, you know, somebody once said that there was recidivism on the part of a Yemeni. Something like that. I don't know if they ever even proved that. But you're saying in this case, they don't even have a bogus excuse like this guy's from Yemen.
No, these guys are from Pakistan, and a number of Pakistanis have been released. We've sued over a number of them. So, for example, we got a juvenile out recently. There's still one kid, Hamidullah, who was 14 at the time he was picked up, and he's still in Bagram. And, you know, one of the great illustrators of the rather farcical nature of all of this is that the U.S. didn't even know how old he was after holding Hamidullah for some years there. So, you know, one of the sort of assessments of how effective intelligence gathering is has to be, if you don't know who the guy is and you don't know how old he is, you probably don't know a lot more about him.
Right. Well, you know, and the whole thing about, and who knows what the number is, I'm sure it's much lower than they bandy about in the media, but they seem to have this idea that if there's a possibility of recidivism, that you just can never let any of these people go. And I think they even carry it over to, right, like, even after they've been cleared, well, look, maybe he wasn't a terrorist before, but now we locked him up for years for no reason and beat the hell out of him over and over again. So we're afraid that if we ever let him go, you know, like Thomas Jefferson, we have the wolf by the ears. He'll bite us right on the face if we let go of him.
It's part of the problem, isn't it? Recidivism is obviously a misnomer if you didn't commit a crime in the first place.
Right.
But, you know, actually, the most recent studies by the Obama administration, and, you know, I think you have to, well, you have to be fairly credulous to believe that they're not overstating the amount of so-called recidivism, but they are saying that the recidivism rate is less than 10% out of Guantanamo since Obama took over. And if you compare that to any other U.S. prison, there's no prison in America where the recidivism rate isn't at least 50% and sometimes sadly higher. So, you know, whatever one says about these things, I think one way of looking at the Guantanamo figures is that because so many people weren't criminals in the first place, they haven't gone out and committed criminal acts. But it is sort of surprising in the sense of what you say, Scott, that actually more people don't do things. I mean, we've treated these people so badly. It's surprising not that more people don't commit bad acts when they get out. I'm glad they don't.
You know, I've always wondered that just about, you know, the falsely convicted here in America when, you know, 25 years later it's finally proven that they didn't do the rape murder they've been serving time for. And they always just say, oh, man, I just want to live my life and wake up in the morning on a soft bed and be near people I know. And you would think, I would think that they would want revenge against the prosecutor that withheld the evidence from their lawyer or whatever it is, but they never say that. They always just say, after 25 years, whatever, just let me see the sunshine.
Well, they do, but I tell you, there's a lot of other collateral damage. In fact, I just published a book about a guy I'm representing in Florida called Chris Maharaj. The book's called The Injustice System, coming out next week in the U.S. And the thing about someone like Chris, who's been facing, he was sentenced to death 26 years ago, and he's still in prison, is that he really suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, he was told that he was going to be electrocuted in Florida's electric chair for a crime that he patently didn't do. And he watched a number of other people, you know, some of whom he knew quite well, being electrocuted. And we tried to put on evidence at one of his hearings about the psychological impact on him. You know, Chris is not going to come out, don't get me wrong, for a second. He's 73. He's not going to come out when we do get him out and do anything. But he's going to come out very, very damaged because he had such a belief in the justice system, and the justice system has, you know, really screwed him over for 26 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, and it seems like the harder they work on looking for innocent people to spring from prison over there at the Innocence Project and other things like that, the more they find, there's just a, for anybody who ever thought that the American justice system really works or something like that, they're finding out. And we're not even talking about, you know, all the things that are illegal that shouldn't be, but just whether they even got the right guy. You would think, I think from TV, people believe that the cops want to get the right guy. When in fact, no, it really just turns out they want to get whoever they can get so that they can move on to the next thing. They really don't care whether you're guilty or not.
I wouldn't state it that way because I think the system is far more dangerous than that. If I thought it was a matter of corruption, I would be much less worried about it because you can locate people who are corrupt because they make mistakes. The much bigger problem is this, that the system is full of people whose biases, you know, they're not bad people, but their biases mean that they do the job in just the sort of way you wouldn't want them to do it. So, for example, I had two British police come to visit me recently in Scotland, wasn't to put handcuffs on me. It was because they were investigating torture. And these two cops had been police for 54 years. And I asked them, how often in those 54 years do you think maybe, possibly, maybe you arrested the wrong guy? They didn't pause for breath before they said, oh, never. You know, we wouldn't do such a thing. And they really believed that. And they were very nice guys. I'm not being critical of them. But the problem is that they reflect a personality process which has been defined in the literature as authoritarian personality. Again, I stress it doesn't make you a bad guy. It means that you believe in the system. You believe the system gets it right. Which means that the police, when they arrest someone, they're not trying to bang up some innocent guy. They genuinely believe he's guilty. And that means that it leads to what's called noble corruption, where people start framing people, not because they're trying to frame an innocent guy, but because they think some devious defense lawyer is going to get a guilty guy off. And that's way more dangerous because their corruption is actually based on the desire to do what they think is right, rather than just sort of pocket money or something like that. And when you look at the justice system, unfortunately, you see that throughout, and it's what I just wrote this book about.
Right, well, and of course there's all these perverse incentives like, you know, moving up in the world where you need a high conviction rate if you're an assistant district attorney and you want to be the real district attorney one day and run for governor 10 years later and that kind of thing. And I love telling this story, and I'm sorry to bring it up all over your interview, but it's so important to me. I was a cab driver, and this is 15 years ago now or something, I don't know, a long, long time ago. But I had a lady in the back of the cab who was an assistant DA from Houston, Texas, for, I guess, Harris County, whatever. And she said that they had a motto inside the district attorney's office in Houston, and that the motto was, if they didn't do it, if they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. And what that meant was, anyone the cops bring us, we crucify. And we don't care. We don't even look into it whether they really did it or not. Our job is to put them in prison. And if they really didn't do it, then it doesn't matter if the burden of proof is on them later for them to try to defend themselves from a prison cell. Screw them. And
well,
she's
you know,
the one, you know.
About that, Scott. One is that you couldn't be a prosecutor and go to work every day in your car or in your taxi, in your case, and say to yourself, how many innocent people am I going to put in prison today? And as a consequence, the most recent studies show that more than 50% of U.S. prosecutors just don't believe in the presumption of innocence. They don't think it's there. But the second thing I think is more important, which is unfortunately when you get to the appellate stage of a case, you know, particularly death penalty cases, which is most of what I've done for my life, then whether you're innocent is under the U.S. Constitution, a case called Herrera versus Collins, the U.S. Supreme Court held that whether you're innocent of the crime is not relevant under the U.S. Constitution to whether you should be executed. Now, that's crazy, crazy, but that's the law. And just as the law is, as you said, that someone in prison, someone who's poor, has no constitutional right to a lawyer to help get them out. They're meant to represent themselves. I mean, you know, every case I've done, and there have been hundreds of people on death row who I've represented who have been condemned to death already, they have no right to funding. I've never been paid for that in my life. And that's really shocking that we have a system that does that.
I think what you're saying is the appeals court, they only review whether there was an error in the process at the regular Pettit court level, the trial level.
And no, that's right. I mean, in the recent case of Troy Davis, who I'm sure you heard of in Georgia, a friend of mine who was doing his appeal suggested that if the federal court, the U.S. Supreme Court or the district court, was 60% sure that Troy was innocent, then they shouldn't execute him. And the court rejected that and said, no, there's no such thing as innocence as a federal constitutional issue. Now, think about what that means. That means that what the lawyer was arguing was, you know, if you toss a coin, you've got a 50-50 chance of getting it right. We're asking you to set this guy free if you're 60% sure he's innocent. But the federal judge said, no, we won't even do that. Now, again, I think that's insanity, that you have a system where the legal result in the end of all of these appeals is less likely to get it right than tossing a coin. It's crazy.
Yeah, sounds about right to me, though. And, of course, if you know anybody, you know, people in the audience, even if you're kind of an upper-middle-class type and you're able to get by in the world without having to deal with the cops too much, if you know anybody who ever has to deal with the cops at all, deal with the court system at all, even for the lowest kind of thing, they'll tell you how cynical it all is and how they, oh, and they make you go to all these classes and you have to pay all these fines, and then the only purpose of being on probation is so they can screw you and revoke it and give you the full sentence anyway after you paid them all this money and spent all this time. You know what I mean? It's just, it's a complete disaster from the very lowest level. You try to appeal a parking ticket, you can only appeal it to the meter maid's boss. That's it. And there is no higher appeal than that. And it's completely corrupt from Guantanamo to the meter maid's office. And there's nothing like even the pursuit of justice anywhere in there that I can tell.
Scott, it sounds like you've got some parking tickets you're still angry about.
No, they're just the worst. And, you know, I grew up on Matlock and a little bit of Perry Mason because my mom watched Perry Mason. But on Matlock and on Perry Mason, every single episode, the prosecutor says, oh, no way, huh? Okay, you're right, Your Honor, I move to dismiss the charges. Apparently I had the wrong guy. But that just never happens, not in real life. They concede nothing.
It doesn't. I was representing a guy out of Louisiana, a 17-year-old kid who was on death row. And we got 6 DNA tests, all done by the government experts, and 5 witnesses, all of whom fingered the guy who really did the crime. They finally set the kid free because they couldn't hold him. But even when they set him free, they held a press conference saying they thought he was still guilty. And it was only because we'd beaten up on him so badly that they had to let him go. And I've never had a DA say that they made a mistake. And I suppose, again, in a way, that's human, that these guys who have put someone on death row, a child in this case, for a crime he didn't commit, it's pretty hard to deal with, and the sort of people who do that work are not likely to admit they made mistakes.
Yeah, it's really too bad. You know what? Well, I want to get back to, well, all this other stuff, but Well, let me just ask you about this. Is it, and I'm no expert in all this, I dropped out of community college, you know, I don't know. I should have taken a logic course or something. But it seems to me like just my basic kind of 101 understanding of inductive and deductive and all that is that the cops are supposed to work, and I'm talking on, you know, any detective case or whatever, they're supposed to work on a deductive basis and, you know, like as best approximating science as they can until they have nothing left. But instead, they really do work backwards like a conspiracy kook, don't they? The cops have standard procedure. They're inductive. And they start with, I think this guy did it. Now let me see whether I can compile a case like that. And they don't try to disprove themselves and make sure. They only try, and I think they're trained that way to think that that's proper and that's what they're supposed to do. That's how you solve a crime, basically, right?
Well, I think there are very few police officers, though, who go around saying, you know, how am I going to get an innocent person today? The problem is that people coming into the profession, and, you know, this is obviously not true of everyone, but you know, there are a lot of prejudices that float around, and I'm not talking about racial prejudices necessarily, but people have their views and they have their shortcuts. So, look, there are very simple logic to some of these things. If two people suspected of the same crime, and one of them did it and one didn't, the one who's going to go to the police first is almost invariably the one who did pull the trigger. And the reason that is everyone believes the system somehow works, bizarrely. You know, they think they're going to get him. So I can't tell you how many cases I've had where there have been two co-defendants on a case. One did the shooting and one didn't. But the one who did the shooting is the one who gets the deal. And then they go after the one who didn't do the shooting, because the one who didn't do the shooting trusts the system to exonerate him, doesn't realize that actually the first person to go snitch is going to be the one who did it, and doesn't realize the police are going to be naive enough almost invariably to accept that. And I think I did a study one time of every single person on death row in Mississippi, and it was true in the majority of cases that the guy who they'd gone after was actually not the trigger man, and the trigger man had got a deal. Now, those are things that reflect people's prejudices, they're biased, they're lazy, they just don't do the investigation necessary. But also, there's so much that goes into this. There are so many bizarre things that happen out in the world, and I don't think the police either have the time or the inclination to really think about you know, what might have happened, what might really have happened in a rather complicated world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's where we get back to TV, is people have their, you know, CSI, perfect science imagination of how it works, and then there's how it really works. But anyway, so let me get back to this great article in The Guardian, because I really wanted to ask you about the drones. I guess I won't have time to do that, but on this piece about Yunus Rahmatullah and Amatullah Ali, you're saying here that the Americans broke the rules as far as their agreements with the British. And maybe this is a minor point, the point of law between, you know, the former empire and its little kid over here. But could you please clarify what you mean?
Well, look, what happened was there's really no question in a sane world of law that what the U.S. is doing in Bagram is a criminal offense. You know, first, the Geneva Conventions apply to all the prisoners we take. Second, you're not allowed to take a prisoner from, you know, one war zone, Iraq in this case, to another war zone, Afghanistan, against their will. That's just illegal. Then you're not allowed to hold them after the end of the war. And according to George Bush, when he made his announcement on you know, the aircraft carrier mission accomplished, you know, the war supposedly ended 8 or 9 years ago, then you can't hold them after you've decided that they're no longer a threat. That's another criminal offense, and yet these guys have been cleared. So the British court found that the U.S. and the U.K. by complicity are guilty of at least 3 war crimes in holding these guys prisoners. They didn't reach what's an obvious 4th one, which is the abuse of them in custody. But, you know, it's a pretty shocking thing when the Supreme Court of Britain, you know, the United States' closest ally, says that what the U.S. is doing is an international war crime, and the people who are doing it are potentially subject to prosecution in international court. That's what the court held, and I think, you know, people should accept that as a wake-up call that the world is about to get pretty angry about some of the things that have happened.
Mm-hmm. I think it was the first one you said there. The Geneva Convention applies to the United States. It doesn't matter who it is that we're at war against. There's a basic point that I forgot to even make. It's been so long that this has been going on. But Obama has not undone this Bush policy that says, well, since you're an unprivileged enemy belligerent or whatever made-up jargon, then that means the law doesn't apply to us and how we treat you anymore.
There's not a single country in the world that agrees with Jack Goldsmith's memorandum that says that the law doesn't apply to the United States. Every single country in the world disagrees with that.
Yeah, well, and it's such an important point, too, and I think, you know, especially for people who lean right in America who might be listening, too, it's not like there's, you know, the UN international government foisted all these laws on us. It's the United States of America that came up with the anti-torture convention and the war crimes, this and that.
Was something the U.S. came up with, and the U.S. signed on August the 16th, 1949. So it's been around for, you know, more than 60 years, and we were the ones who came up with it, and I'm proud of that fact, because right after World War II, what we as Americans did, and I may not sound it, but I'm American, you know, what we did was really positive and good, and I'm pleased we did it. The trouble is we're now undermining it.
Yeah, well, it applies to everybody to be enforced by us, just like the local cops. We're immune from whatever we do to somebody in the name of enforcing the law. So there we are, full circle. All right, well, geez, I wanted to talk with you about the drones, but I got to go, and our half hour
another
is up,
time.
But maybe we can do this interview sometime soon.
Good. All right. Another time. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much for your time, Clive. Appreciate it.
See you. Bye-bye.
Everybody, that's Clive Stafford Smith. He is the founder and director of Reprieve at reprieve.org.uk, and you can find him oftentimes in The Guardian. This one is Eunice Rumatula, the U.S. and U.K. caught committing a crime together.
Ben Franklin said those who are willing to sacrifice essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither. Hi, Scott Horton here for the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's a plain card-sized steel Bill of Rights designed to set off the metal detectors anywhere the police state goes, so you can remind those around you the freedoms we've lost. And for a limited time, get free shipping when you purchase a frequent flyer pack of 5 Bill of Rights Security Edition cards. Play a leading role in the security theater with a Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Join the great Jacob Hornberger and some of the best writers in the libertarian movement like James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more for a real individualist take on the most important matters of peace, liberty, and prosperity in our society. That's the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including How to End the War on Terror, The Case Against War with Iran, Central Banking in War, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, The Ongoing War on Civil Liberties, and of course, Why Everything in the World is Woodrow Wilson's Fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.